explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be a pretty easy and fun place to live if everybody just minded their own business.
We were walking right on the edge.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Inside Track with David Pullen and Jason Kennedy.
It's used the ticking time bomb of tension.
How you all doing? I'd like to introduce Jason Kennedy. Hello, Jason. How you doing, man?
Fine,
thanks. Are you okay?
You're still playing me that music, Dave.
You don't like it, no?
Well, it was playing over your voice, so I can't hear you. I'm not sure if you're just drowning me out.
No, I wouldn't do that, Jay. What would give you that impression?
Another technical hiccup to start the show off.
I'm full of them, mate. I'm full of them.
Well, I've just made a note about that music that was playing before. We'll bring that up at the AGM.
Okay, well, yeah. Annual general meeting. So there's only one, so make sure...
It made me want to move.
Right, okay. So just before we start, would like to thank Julie for the previous 2 hours. And if you'd like to get in touch with us at all, you can mooch over to our newly designed website, thanks to Jason. Jason has done some stunning work on our new website. It's like the old website, but looks better. And also now works on mobile devices. That is at bookarmor.com. Book, A-R-M-O-R. It's American spelling, as I say every week. Bookarmor.com. Would like to go over there. And on there, you will also see a C-box, which is a chat box where you can drop off any feedback, which would be really appreciated. We've not had much. We're now on episode 9. So, Jay. Hello.
Hi there, Dave.
So, your week, how's it been?
One more week in this hotspot for geological conflict at the moment. So, personally, I've not done very much apart from get up and go to work, like most people.
Yeah.
But there's been a few more developments in terms of North Korea, South Korea and Japan and Taiwan this week. None of them very good, right, has to be said.
Okay, pray tell.
Well, South Korea and the US have been staging their annual joint military exercise. They call it Operation Foul Eagle. Not sure why. And every year they do this, and this year's was made a little special because they've made a new plan. They can't tell you anything about the plan, but the diplomat has a reference saying that this plan rehearses the decapitation of the entire senior leadership of the North Korean government, while the residual part of the plan is just your general wiping out all of their defenses. So 28,000 U.S. troops and their South Korean counterparts are engaged in this, must be stressed, wholly defensive military exercise, which of course, no reasonable country would have any untoward feelings about that happening on their doorstep every year.
All
right. So basically it kind of gives, I was thinking about this, have you heard of Public Enemy?
What, the band?
Yeah, cool.
Oh, right, okay. As in not the Social Outcast.
Well, Public Enemy had an album and the title was It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am familiar with that.
Maybe our listeners are too. But my point of comparison here is, if you think about the rhetoric inside North Korea, the fact that the most powerful nation on the planet feels obliged to post 25,000 of its troops with the latest technology within a few hundred kilometers of their borders. If you're going to sell your people the line, you know, that you're an absurdly powerful adversary for the USA, it may sound preposterous for us sat here in London or Taiwan, but it does kind of do their work for them when the US insists on keeping such a military buildup in place. That would be my point about the way the US presence kind of works towards fostering the paranoia inside North Korea. You can't treat that paranoia as if it, you know, was born out of nothing. They're kind of rightly afraid.
But wasn't I was going to say, wasn't the US and the Allies doing various exercises in Europe not so long ago? It was supposed to be the biggest exercise in, you know, since the Second World War, from all accounts. And they were doing the same thing to Russia, basically.
Yeah, basically, there are those classic kind of internet memes where they say there's you'll have a picture of Iran or Russia or China, and it will have this thing saying, God, look at these guys. Look how close they put their country to all our US military bases. There's this kind of thing. But it really didn't receive much mention in the UK media that it's quite a big deal for the European mainland and Germany, because there were these big deliveries of nuclear weapons or warheads to Germany. So they were being unloaded by the US, and those were being shuffled across. And as you say, the US and its kind of NATO partners then engaged in some giant, well, they call them exercises, but pretty much right on the Russian border. I know this is an old kind of point, an old way to think about this, but it is always worth reversing the scenarios and thinking about, you know, if the Russians and the Iranians went to Mexico and started doing some defensive military exercise that rehearsed wiping out American cities. I don't think the American people would find that too amusing. There was a very funny story a year or two ago that highlighted this. The US media ran a scare story saying Iranians have a missile capable of striking Washington, D.C. And what emerged was, this missile would be capable of hitting Washington if it was brought all the way across to the Gulf of Mexico on a ship and then launched from there, had a range of about 200 kilometers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same as 2003, wasn't it, when we went to Iraq and we had millions of people all throughout the UK and various other countries basically saying, no, we don't want to go and have an illegal war. But Tony Blair and obviously George W. Bush decided to go against popular, you know, sort of feelings at the time. And Tony Blair's government released the dodgy dossier, which had accusations. Excuse me a minute. Had accusations of the 45-minute claim. Very similar in the sense that Saddam had missiles that could reach London in 45 minutes.
So, yeah. If he launched them from Woolwich.
Yeah. You just have to literally push them out the back of the truck.
But the Sun ran that as their front page. Later, they kind in the intervening years, they've kind of sort of tried to deny having done that, and the headlines kind of disappeared off their website. But every now and then, on my Facebook feed, some well-meaning citizen reposts that preposterous claim from the Sun that went out, you know, on the front page there, so everyone could view it over breakfast.
Our first topic.
That was going on, and then the other part. Oh, sorry, I was going to say, just to round off the Asian thing, is that Taiwan is now engaged in talks with the US because it appears that Donald Trump's government, his administration, is more eager to sell Taiwan some improved defenses than Obama was. So for me here, sat here in Taiwan, you know, it used to be every week when we started off, the Taiwan segment would be kind of trivial and frivolous, and then we'd get into the meat of all these developments all over the planet that were kind of key and would shape our collective futures. Now, the things happening here, unfortunately, are, you know, actually the big events, the major events are kind of going on around me. It's a bit uncomfortable. The future outlook, it's one of those disturbing thoughts, Dave. I'm going to have to put it on a bus and let it drive away.
A bus to where, though?
I don't know. Not a bus across Westminster Bridge.
No. Yeah, I mean, that, interestingly enough, I was watching Carlson, Tuckerton, or Tucker Carlson, I should say,
on Fox News last night, and he had Katie Hopkins on it. And she was, I would have clipped it, but I didn't come across the clip until this morning. But she was doing her usual, sowing seeds of disunity. In fact, she was saying that the UK has never been so disunified in history. I was wondering whether that would be true or not. I don't think so, Jim, somehow.
No, disunified was a word. I think you just introduced me to a new one.
Yeah, that courtesy of unification.
I think disunited might be the idea. The disunited kingdom could be a catchy new name for the country, perhaps.
Yeah, we'll be four countries all living next door to each other, but we won't actually be a union anymore. If, you know, Nicola Sturgeon had her way, that's what would be happening.
And if Gerry Adams has his way too, he's speaking the same language this week, as we noted on an earlier show. Now, about the attack yesterday, I've got a few different lines on the thing, just to kind of show that one of these events will kind of happen, and then, you know, people go off in their kind of different directions with different elements of the story, different parts of the story, to then kind of bolster whichever view of the world they have. So I am going to spring this one on you, rather, because I didn't share this with you before the show went out. But this is from a gentleman known as, well, it might be his real name, not just known as, it could be his actual name, Max Hastings.
No, I'm not familiar with the name.
You're not familiar with Max Hastings? Private Eye, for any readers, readers of Private Eye or old school readers, he used to be known as Hitler Hastings because of partly the physical resemblance and partly the political views. There is some overlap. But Max Hastings' take is this, and really I can just kind of read the headline to you. If our phones have to be tapped by the spooks, then so be it. We must back intelligence agencies in fight against terror, writes Max Hastings. And he then proceeds from there. If Max Hastings doesn't mind it, then neither should you. I always think this is kind of a curious argument, isn't it? Because there are people out there that enjoy all kinds of degrading treatment, and it's not always the best argument to say, you know, didn't do me any harm. You know, and then now it's your turn. So I'm never quite convinced that's a sound argument. But what do you think about Max's proposal there, Dave?
Well, my first thought would be the fact that that's already happening, isn't it? He's trying to get across that that's what should happen. I would suggest that's already happening.
It does seem a little bit like that, doesn't it? An example, the story's coming out that this gentleman was already known to the intelligence agencies and had been dismissed as a peripheral figure. Apparently, there's a kind of chart. It's not like that Alan Freeman, Gallup Top 40, but there's a list, and terrorists can move up and down this I don't know what you call it then, top of the terrorist pops or something, but they can go up and down, and it's quite a long list. There's 3,000 names on it.
Wow.
And apparently this guy doesn't even make the top 3,000. So that's why he'd kind of been put to bed. There was no kind of active surveillance of this guy. He was just considered, in Theresa May's own terminology, he was peripheral. I did find an article actually to accompany that said that the intelligence agencies only actively monitor 3,000 people.
No
and
way.
Supposedly these are all these extremists, and most of them are Islamic extremists in the UK. I find that kind of preposterous.
Yeah.
When you consider, as you just said, all kinds of people seem to be having information collected about them, and many of them don't seem to have any connection to terrorism. Many of them are environmental campaigners. We may go on to talk about it a little later, but Jenny Jones, I think she's a Dame Jenny Jones. She's a Green Party politician. Now, she already knows that she's being monitored, and that she has a file with this domestic extremism unit, which has gone through, it's had various name changes, but it's based inside the Metropolitan Police Service. But there's a story this week about her having been hacked again by the Metropolitan Police Service. So maybe we can come on to that.
Right.
So the first thing I would kind of agree with you, that the Max Hastings thing is, there's always this give them everything they need kind of rhetoric. So he goes down that line. All right. So that's one takeaway. Now, my next one would be, there's this one over on the Telegraph. ISIS, or ISIL, as they call them at the Telegraph, Daesh, whatever you want to call them, you know, I think we know who we're referring to.
Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda. But what they've got here is that the chatter in extremist circles, so they're on social media just like me and you, only they're celebrating this attack. And it's got some of the reaction from these people. And there's one here of Big Ben on fire. Not the best Photoshop work, if we're going to assess it kind of,
as hoaxes go, yeah.
But it says, soon, our battle on your land not started yet. Be upon you, only waiting. The grammar is terrifying, if nothing else.
That's very similar to Occupy Wall Street and, what's the other one with the wear the masks?
Wear the mask, I don't...
Yeah, the Guy Fawkes mask.
Anonymous?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, you mean the graphic is kind of similar?
No, but in the sense that the use of the language there, where they kind of, you know, try and make it intimidating by missing out certain words. So it's kind of what... I'm trying to think of the name of the group. Can't think of the name. They wear the Guy Fawkes mask. Fawkes.
It's Anonymous.
Yeah, Anonymous, that's the one. So they phrase their threats when they're threatening companies to do hacks or whatever it is. They use a very similar kind of language, actually.
Well, they actually used to use that, "all your base are belong to us." That was one of their favourite memes from an old video game, which was deliberately kind of, bad English was what made it catchy.
Yeah.
But the point here is, on this Telegraph story, it's about the way ISIS regard this attack as being kind of blood for blood. Because it's in retaliation for the US-led coalition's campaign in Iraq and Syria against the jihadists. So this is one way to interpret the attack as well and to see it as kind of justified. Now, going along with that, if you're going to sort of judge the merits of such an opinion, now I know the way kind of public discourse is framed in the UK, you're not usually meant to kind of entertain the idea that Islamists have any particular grievances. We're supposed to believe that they all originate in them verses from the Quran rather than events on the ground. But I would point you towards the fact that the RAF YouTube account, the Ministry of Defense YouTube account, has a video up this week. RAF destroys Daesh HQ in Syria, 18th of March 2017. 35 seconds of a RAF tornado delivering its payload to this, anonymous-looking building in the middle of nowhere. And then we're told at the end, read more at Defence HQ and on the Ministry of Defence website, airstrikes against Daesh, Ministry of Defence protecting our people. So, you see, the UK government itself has this kind of logic that, you know, they are out there taking care of these people in order to, what? Who are our people would be my question there. Is it just the people that serve in the armed forces? Is it just the people that work for large British businesses? Is it just the government? Or are we seriously meant to entertain the idea that these actions are done on behalf of the safety and well-being of 60 million UK citizens? And actually, if we listen to Theresa May, it's not even 60 million UK citizens that these bombings defend. It's the entire free world, if we listen to her reaction. Okay. So this is the kind of the ISIL reaction. Now, the last one I've got is if you go with the kind of this is the more crackpot version. So I'll see what you think about this. This one delves, instead of into the attack itself, this one is straight into the numerology of the date of the attack.
7.
If you add the numbers together and then divide them by themselves and multiply them by another number, and then divide them again, the actual number equals a number between 0 and 9, which terrifyingly, meaningful. That's the kind of logic here. So it's got one here saying It happened on the anniversary of the attacks in Brussels.
Yep,
which
I heard
is,
that
which
one,
is
yeah.
true. But then it does say it features the number 3-2-2. Mm-hmm. Now this 3-2-2 is
that would be
secret number of the Skull and Bone
Skull and Bone Society
at Yale
man.
University, George Bush, John Kerry, and we're not far from dancing naked in the firelight at Bohemian Grove. So this is another approach to these events, which is to just kind of fabricate connections or just see things where there's nothing. So some people are contenting themselves with this on the internet this week.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the new numerology thing, that's interesting though, that is the, you know, it adds up to the 3-3-2, that is the 3-2-2.
One thing it does mention though is that, and this is a true fact about the attack, is that CCTV cameras for Westminster are supposedly offline since September.
Yeah, that I can't see that happening.
Talk about this in the Evening Standard. Now, I've been to Westminster last year. I've walked up and down it. It's not big, but you know, it's still sizable. How many cameras do you believe there were before they turned them off? Given that the UK has the highest density of surveillance cameras in the world, and that London is the city with the highest concentration of those surveillance cameras, how many do you think there were that being run by the local authority?
Is it a ridiculously stupid high number? Over 1,000? What is it?
Okay, more of the ridiculously low number.
Why? How so?
How many fingers have you got?
Well, 8, including 2 thumbs.
Oh, tricky.
Yeah.
You'd need a few friends, but 75 cameras, apparently.
75? How is that possible? Because
be many guarding the mayor's parking spot.
Yeah, but don't they say that on average, and I think this was a British stat that came out, that the average person on there mooching around in an average day gets caught by CCTV around about 300 times a day?
Yeah, well, not in Westminster.
No, blatantly not. They need to keep certain cameras out of, you know, we don't want to see children going into the back of the Houses of Parliament, maybe.
Yeah, that is true. It does say that the CCTV in the area run by Transport for London, private businesses and on housing estates will continue to operate. Now, one thing I think it's highly unlikely that there aren't more cameras there.
Yeah,
potentially,
businesses.
There's a private network of surveillance so that any footage gathered doesn't have to be shown to the public. But the idea that you've been around in that area enough times, you can't tell me that there's no real visual surveillance being conducted of Whitehall of the Palace of Westminster or Millbank and these kind of key parts of the UK's infrastructure.
It's not just that, but I mean, the way, from my understanding, and of course they give you this on the BBC and on Sky or whatever it is, and they always have a reporter in the control room with hundreds, you know, dozens of cameras surveilling every inch. So why is it if the rest of London is basically surveilled to this extent, but seemingly Westminster and Whitehall isn't? Really? I would have thought that would have been more so.
Yeah, you usually have someone from the BBC lecturing you on how our intelligence agencies or the Metropolitan Police can read a phone number on a fag packet from Mars or whatever, like this kind of thing. So apparently you can be doing whatever you want in Westminster, and there's not a single, not really much by way of infrastructure to sort of catch you. I did find that part kind of interesting. It doesn't mean that anything at all to do with this attack is kind of fabricated.
No, but there was an interesting...
It is certainly interesting that they would have the public believe that there isn't a kind of surveillance network in place. They're surveilling everything else. They're not going to have any surveillance for that. You'd think they'd want to know every single movement going on around there with all their facial recognition technology rolled out and all the rest of it.
which has seriously moved on in recent years and is basically being rolled out in various ways. Yeah, it's, I mean, interesting. There was a couple of things that I came across to do with this in the last couple of days. Someone sent me a video yesterday of a BBC journalist who, and this video would have been posted 3 or 4 days ago, 3 days yesterday, so 4 days today. And in this, he is doing a press release, very lo-fi, and it's labelled as a terrorist attack in Westminster. And this would have been posted 3 days ago, 4 days ago. So this is it, people are then making the leap. And I've seen the video. From all accounts, the YouTube date stamp on it cannot be fabricated, and it does say that it's, you know, several days older than the actual Westminster terrorist attack, as it's now known to become. And he basically lines out that certain things, explosions were happening and stuff like this. People are making the link then to what happened on 9/11 with Tower 7 being, you know, BBC predicting 20 minutes before it came down. So the people are making that kind of connection. It's a little bit odd that this particular footage has come to where. So.
Well, people do say you can't fabricate the YouTube timestamp, but sometimes there's been evidence that someone posted a video on the day in question, but then swapped out the video afterwards.
Right.
So the original video's day is prior to the event. If they really had this kind of information that there's going to be some terror attack, like some kind of false flag or this kind of operation on that day, why don't they just go down to Westminster Bridge wearing a T-shirt saying, you know, I know what's coming? Or they could wear a T-shirt with, you know, some kind of way to interact with the event itself. That would be the ultimate in kind of gonzo journalism. You know, it would be fascinating if one of the bodies that was found by the paramedics on Westminster Bridge was wearing a T-shirt that had a YouTube video still on there saying, you know, I know, I already know I've just been hit by a car or something like this. That would be, that would really confound the global audience. But instead, like I say, the date on the YouTube video,
yeah,
it's not,
maybe.
To me, it's not that persuasive. There is another wrinkle, though, that I'd like to mention that it's not really necessarily contradictory, but I do think it's interesting, and that's if we talk about this Tobias Elwood MP.
Right. Okay.
You're aware of this? He's the MP with the blood on his forehead.
This is the one. He was in the forces, wasn't he? And allegedly, the story goes that as he was running out, people were saying, well, you know, where are you going? What are you on a mission? And he was rushing out to help people. I believe he was helping the police officer that got killed.
He was.
Yeah.
And the Mirror, I've got this story on the Mirror about him, and he's being praised. He's a hero today.
Yeah.
But he's being praised for his incredible bravery because he rushed to help the policeman who was stabbed. And, all right, I'm going to go into this a little bit more okay. So you can kind of see the links here. But this is the same Tobias Elwood who was quoted as saying, to widespread astonishment, Saudi Arabia should make more of its human rights successes, by Foreign Office Minister Tobias Elwood. Human rights groups say remarks from Minister for the Middle East in wake of mass execution are astonishing. But yes, he did say this. He's basically been one of the drivers of the government's policy of being utterly unmovable on the question of supplying lots of military technology and munitions to Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that it's been engaged in this action against Yemen, which again, the British armed forces have kind of participated in. So we got that story there with him praising the Saudis on their human rights record. And then we've got this, you mentioned the control room.
Yes.
Well, Tobias went on a trip to Saudi Arabia, and he was very impressed, and he's got a tweet here. Visit to the highly impressive Saudi Digital Extremism Observatory, where a team of 300 work round the clock to remove Daesh online content. And as someone else has usefully pointed out, he said, well, there's 600 Saudis in the room next door creating the content. He seems completely oblivious to the fact that Saudi Arabia is the global sponsor of Islamic terrorism. Now, the point I wanted to make here is not, this would be the kind of simple point, right? The simple view would be to dispute that he's a hero, or to dispute, you know, or to call him a hypocrite in some way, because he doesn't seem really to care too much about life and limb in Yemen, or people executed under the kind of brutal regime of the Saudis. When he's got his hat on in his day job, it's strictly business before human rights. But when this attack happened yesterday, he did show like great presence of mind and in extreme circumstances, and did his best to help his sort of fellow man. No, rather than say he's a hypocrite, I'd rather say that it does show that the personal qualities of politicians probably most of the time is not really the issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the logic of governments and the logic of the economics are that when he's doing his day job there as minister for the Middle East, you know, it really is a case of just basically ignoring the human costs and only placing the well-being of the UK economy and the bottom line of particular corporations ahead, you know, of all these other considerations. So someone in Yemen obviously doesn't mean much to Tobias Elwood, but another human being's life right there in front of him inside the Palace of Westminster, and he's more than willing to sort of get involved. So yeah, I did find it interesting that it's a figure, a political figure who's actually a kind of apologist for one of the worst human rights offenders on the planet there, is actually there in the mirror today being proclaimed a hero.
You mentioned a bit ago about Theresa May, and that there was what was your general overview of what we have a clip of it, and there was a particular segment that you wanted me to clip, which was where she kind of droned on about where the location was, because they say location is important. It was in the center of the oldest democracy, the freedom, rule of law. I mean,
just paraphrase, perhaps you can play it, but yeah, what we've been getting at here, like we said, is it's not really a complicated event. The actual incident: car drives across a bridge, hitting people, smashes into the gates of Parliament. There's a struggle, and a police officer dies. Then the assailant is shot dead. That's not complicated, and it's one guy, and they've named him today. He's a guy called by his name. You know, I thought it'd be Wayne Phillips or something like this, but no, instead it's someone called, I think it's Khalid Massoud.
Right. Let's have a listen to.
I always learn a new name from these kinds of incidents.
Right.
But the point is, Theresa May came out, and of course, you know, each person tries to place the event in the way that suits them. I thought Theresa May, is you going to play it or not? Otherwise, I would just kind of.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to stop. Here we go.
A long time. Okay, you can play it.
Right, hold on then.
Chris chose to strike at the heart of our capital city, where people of all nationalities, religions and cultures come together to celebrate the values of liberty, democracy and freedom of speech. These streets of Westminster, home to the world's oldest parliament, are ingrained with a spirit of freedom that echoes in some of the furthest corners of the globe. And the values our Parliament represents, democracy, freedom, human rights, the rule of law, command the admiration and respect of free people everywhere. That is why it is a target for those who reject those values.
Oh, there you go. Interesting.
Yeah.
A little bit over the top.
The Independent. Whereas I took a transcript of her supposed statement from The Independent. I knew it wasn't accurate, I don't know what they're doing at the Independent. Maybe they used one that was handed out by an official. I knew she said freedom. They've got the thing saying here, free speech, liberty, human rights and the rule of law. But that's not quite what she said. She said democracy, freedom, human rights and the rule of law there when you played it. But I thought the interesting thing, of course, democracy, this is the, I don't know if you have the Peter Stefanovich clip of Theresa May being caught lying on the BBC. But this is the party, this woman leads the party who basically failed to cooperate with the investigation into Tory fixing of expenses at the last general election. Although she sat there on presumably a chair on the BBC. I don't know what Theresa May likes to sit on. And she said that her party had cooperated fully. That is absolutely a lie. And then the other part of it would be that the Tories' misdeeds in terms of election funding at the last election, they don't really show much respect for democracy, leaving aside the fact that this parliament, this old parliament that she kind of venerates on the basis of its age. Yeah, this parliament is one of the things that's in the way of democracy in the UK now. Its age really is just a demonstration of how unfit for purpose it is in the 21st century. The Tories are not, by any stretch of the imagination, the party of choice of the majority of the British electorate, but they have a crushing majority in the House of Commons thanks to this ridiculous first-past-the-post system that the Tories and Labour have kind of chained us to and are just adamant about, you know, opening up the system. Instead, they'd like to moan about how few people can be bothered to vote. They can't quite see the link between, you know, having a product that people are interested in and having demand for that product. They don't see their own kind of obsolescence. So there's the democracy part, but then I thought the freedom of speech part was kind of interesting too. If you are going to enjoy freedom of speech, then you have to have a way to communicate kind of privately, one would presume. It's not just about what you can say on the street corner, although we do see that people can be arrested for tweeting that they're going to blow up an airport because they're plane their flight has been cancelled. You must remember that story.
Yeah, wasn't there also a story of a British couple that were going to America for a holiday and had tweeted out or put on social media that they were going to paint the town red, and they ended up being refused entry into the country because, you know, they didn't know the, you know, British colloquialism of going out to paint the town red meant going out and having a whale of a time.
If you said have a whale of a time, that might be kind of problematic too. Who knows if your itinerary features SeaWorld in Florida. There was another case where someone in David Cameron's constituency, I think it was a school child, wanted to ask him some kind of question or pose something on social media, and the police turned up at the school. There's all kinds. I'm not saying that the freedom of speech in the UK rivals, you know, the crushing of free speech rivals certain regimes around the world, usually the ones that the UK government is so keen on selling arms and riot control stuff to
business partners.
But it is amusing, grimly amusing, that over the last 15 years since 9/11, it does seem that the right to dissent is kind of under constant pressure. As I said, Dame Jenny Jones and all kinds of environmental campaigners. Are we really to believe that Greenpeace members are a genuine threat to national security? Is that really something that we're supposed to be able to get behind? What's your angle on that?
Well, in a sense, wasn't it the guy who, one of the founding members of Greenpeace, he did an appearance, it's on YouTube, a video where he then lays out the reason why he left Greenpeace, and basically he was suggesting that Greenpeace had been co-opted by various groups, some of which were like man-made climate change groups, and basically he left the organisation that he founded because it had been co-opted and basically was going off in a completely different direction as a result. So if they are scared of someone from Greenpeace, they're probably scared of their own groups that co-opted it. It's one of those, I would suggest.
Well, it's still difficult to believe they're a threat to national security.
Yeah, exactly.
For people who don't understand the background to this, Jenny Jones, as I mentioned earlier, she's already had confirmation that a file was kept on her, along with people like Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott, a whole bunch of MPs. They've all been tracked over the years by a unit of the Metropolitan Police. There was a guy who came forward a couple of years ago to The Guardian after the Mark Kennedy story broke, the spy cop. And this guy came forward and basically explained what that his work had been going out and kind of collecting notes on the kinds of things these individuals were saying at public meetings and any kind of scuttlebutt he could collect. This also ties in his work there was when it was disclosed that the Metropolitan Police planted spies inside the Lawrence family, the family of Stephen Lawrence, because they wanted to know the next moves of the family, not because they were regarded as a threat to national security, but they certainly were regarded as a threat to the Metropolitan Police Service's business as usual. So the Dame Jenny Jones thing is kind of linked to this. Now, what she's found is someone sent her a letter, and the letter says that hundreds of email accounts were monitored without legal authority. And the way the Metropolitan Police did this was one of them had a friend, a connection in India. And so basically, they farmed out cracking the email accounts of their persons of interest to this Indian connection, and who then in turn employed just hackers to do it. And so Jenny Jones was sent this letter that contained numerous like logins and passwords of accounts of people who'd been hacked. These have been shown to the individuals concerned, and they've kind of confirmed that, yeah, these are the passwords that they were using at particular periods in time. Now, to deepen this this kind of illegal activity, the picture even more, it's also reported that the Metropolitan Police Service are busy shredding enormous quantities of material that is supposed to be preserved for this ongoing Pitchford inquiry into undercover policing. So, you know, you put the whole thing together here. Certainly challenges the idea. If it doesn't challenge the idea of free speech in a direct way, although Jenny Jones says it does have a kind of chilling effect on you when you know the state is reading through your private correspondence. But it certainly you have to look towards the idea of the rule of law when the police can't seem to manage to obey the laws. I'm not really sure what situation we're in there.
Well, if the end result of basically knowing that people are going through your emails is that you're going to be very careful on what you say and what you do. So, yeah, as I heard on some show that I listen to on a regular basis, they call it moral self-licensing. So when you are basically under the watchful eye, you're more likely to watch your own behaviour for fear of having others tell you it's wrong. So, yeah.
Well, sometimes they call it self-censorship or self-policing. It all goes back to that kind of idea of, I think it was an 18th century idea of the panopticon. You probably heard about this concept to do with surveillance.
Go on then. Explain.
Well, there's a very interesting man actually called Jeremy Bentham. Mm-hmm. And he was a kind of, he wrote on all kinds of topics, but he's a legal theorist among other things. But one thing he designed was this thing called the panopticon. And pan kind of means like all, opticon, like all seeing eye kind of approach. So this was a prison, like a hypothetical prison. It was never built. But in the center was a kind of elevated post from which a single person or a couple of people could observe every part of the prison because of the arrangement around this central feature. But the point was, there was a kind of ledge there that would conceal the people doing the viewing. So the viewer would be concealed. What this would mean is, effectively, that prisoners wouldn't know if they're being watched or not. But potentially, they were always being watched. And the idea here is that prisoners would begin to behave, you know, in a manner, you know, appropriate to those conditions. They would be disciplining themselves. They would be restraining themselves. They would be policing themselves effectively. So in terms of surveillance, it's often used as a kind of metaphor you know, for the kind of situation that a government might seek to impose upon its citizens, one where you're never sure which moments you're being watched and which you're not. So you tend to have to assume that you're always being watched.
Right.
Now, on a lighter note, one of the Greenpeace members that was hacked and by Scotland Yard is a man called Colin Newman, who's an ex-civil servant and whose basic mission is to raise awareness of the damage being done to the oceans. And he does this by attending many public events dressed as a fish. And there's a big picture of him on the BBC website here in action as a fish. So, and that's the kind of person that Scotland Yard is busily monitoring on our behalf.
Yeah, right. And I know we're going to get into this in a bit, but I like these little stories that are trying to convince people that basically, you know, you have to be a certain kind of person in order to come underneath, like, the surveillance system. That's just, from what I know, that's just not true. We're all under it, seemingly, apart from Westminster. But Westminster doesn't seem to be surveilled half as much as the next road over, probably. Do you know what I mean? But
there used to be, I don't know if you know about this, but there used to be in the 1970s a man who used to appear on TV all the time. And he was half a man and like half an ostrich. And he would ride around on this ostrich and do all kinds of things. I think he was called Bernie Clifton.
Bernie Clifton, yeah. Yeah.
Not Rod Hull and Emu. I wonder if he was being monitored too. It appears that anyone that dresses like an animal is fair game.
Is that so the specific social reference you're making today?
The human rights angle of Theresa May, because we can see that actually the UK certainly doesn't stand for the protection of human rights. I mean, I don't know how anyone could honestly suggest that the UK is a beacon or an exemplar in any way of the protection of human rights around the world. The argument just cannot be made in the light of the evidence. Just as the idea that the US, as they will repeatedly tell you, that the US is the primary upholder of human rights or a champion of human rights around the world, it just simply cannot be matched with the evidence. It can only be a claim, a self-justifying claim. Theresa May's theme was really very close to the George Bush one. Why do they hate us? They hate us for our freedom. Theresa May's argument was they hate these precious values which we exemplify and that we cherish. And that is why, you know, they will always want to harm us. She can't say anything about the RAF fighter on the YouTube channel destroying these Daesh HQs out in Syria. One, if you destroy the actual HQ of ISIS, they'll get angry and they'll want to attack you. Two, if you actually just hit a bunch of civilians instead, actually, that is pretty good kind of recruitment campaign for these kind of groups too. But Theresa May's got nothing to say on that topic, even though her government at the same moment, you know, different arms of the government are kind of promoting their role, as the Ministry of Defence like to say, protecting our people.
Right, so we were going to be talking about Katie Hopkins.
I'm having another one of those disturbing thoughts.
Which is?
Well, just that whole section, thinking about Theresa May. The fact that that she's there, that she's the leader of I don't know if we can really call it our country, but you know, she's the leader of, well, it is our country in a way, but it's not our country in the deeper way.
No.
How these people assume their positions is just kind of troubling. And I pity anyone who took her at her word when she said those words.
Well, that's generally the mantra that these politicians, it's generally what they come out with at times of need. I mean, David Cameron has done the same thing. Tony Blair, obviously, classic classic, the amount of times he's been on telly. At some point, some people are thinking that guy's going to try and make a comeback. My God, let's hope not. So, shall we skip the Katie Hopkins and go straight on to Trump Poo?
Might be an idea.
Yeah.
We can move on to Trump Poo.
Yeah, all right then. Because it's along the similar lines. So.
Well, no, the Katie Hopkins thing is worth coming back to later, but maybe after you know, it's like eating Brussels sprouts. You don't want to carry on and eat, you know, cauliflower right afterwards. It's enough, you know. I need a little break from Theresa May first, and Katie Hopkins will save her for later.
There's something I'd never thought. Theresa May and Katie Hopkins sandwich.
Love Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, but I've never met any of those people.
So, did you hear this morning then? So, there was, I think it's the House of, it's an intelligence guy in the American government has come out and he's backed up Trump, saying that the likelihood is that he was correct in saying that Obama had wiretapped his phones and the transition team as a whole. So I know we're going to talk about what Judge Napolitano, who used to work on Fox News, sadly, because of his comments, got laid off a few days ago. What do you know about Napolitano? Are you familiar with him before today, Jay?
Yeah, I'm familiar with him. It's just this kind of tough-talking judge, former judge that they have on there. He speaks a little bit like Kojak. He's kind of a tough guy. So if you enjoy his spiel. But he's certainly not a minor figure on the network. So I did say to you when we spoke about it before the show that actually these comments about GCHQ spying on Donald Trump, I was suggesting to you that these have caused far deeper, ructions behind the scenes than you might imagine in terms of the relationships between the bedrock of the relationship between the US and UK being their intelligence relationship. And you were kind of like, well, really? Do you think that's really the case? And the fact that Fox rapidly dispensed with this guy who's been on their network for many years. He's not just the weatherman on Fox News, but yeah, he was dispatched within short order because this one crossed a line. It might not be a line for what we would think you could say in public, but for the US-UK relationship between their governments, that was over the line.
Right.
They're just something that you can't say.
Right, okay, Jay. Before we continue, let's have a listen. I've got a clip of Sean Spicer, so Trump's press secretary, and what he does is he quotes Napolitano. So let's have a listen.
Last on Fox News on March 14th, Judge Andrew Napolitano made the following statement. Quote, three intelligence sources have informed Fox News that President Obama went outside the chain of command. He didn't use the NSA. He didn't use the CIA. He didn't use the FBI. And he didn't use the Department of Justice. He used GCHQ. What is that? It's the initials for the British Intelligence Spying Agency. So simply by having two people saying to them, President needs transcripts of conversations involving candidate Trump's conversations involving President-elect Trump, he's able to get it, and there's no American fingerprints on this. Putting the published counts and common sense together, this leads to a lot. That happened, I think, 2 days ago. It was something that was, reported on air. And I think the point is that there's been it has not been raised. But I do think that, again, all we're doing is literally reading off what other stations and people have reported. And I think that casts into concern some of the activities that may have occurred during the 16 election. We're not casting judgment on that. I think the idea is to say that if these organizations, these individuals came to these conclusions, they merit looking into.
Right. So let's just get what he said there. He's basically suggested that the American government, because there would be legal ramifications if they were to spy on their own people. So what they've done is they've approached GCHQ, and then GCHQ has basically managed to spy on them, and this has resulted in America basically not leaving any fingerprints on the fact that indeed they seems to have been wiretapped. Now, in my understanding, Jay, And it came out some time ago. That is exactly what the United States and the UK are doing, because they are legally restricted in the sense of not being able to spy on their own citizens. The way they get around that is that they head straight over to their allies. And that's GCHQ working on behalf of the Americans, snooping on Americans, and then the Americans snoop on the British. That's what generally happens.
That is the case. Snowden documents revealed.
Exactly.
For one, the Snowden documents revealed that GCHQ is very much dependent upon the goodwill of the NSA to continue its operations, even on the financial side. The US government invested £100 million in GCHQ. In return, GCHQ was internally was bragging about how much of their take, their intelligence take, they kind of shared with the NSA. And of the raw intercepts, one figure I saw, I'll put it on the website, but it said 35% was what they were sharing. And also said that when GCHQ provided intelligence that was of particular use to the NSA, that it would be, you know, port and cigars time at GCHQ. So there is a part of them, GCHQ's very much central to their thinking, which is to be pleasing the NSA in order to keep this relationship going. One GCHQ guy was quoted as his quip was, they have the money and we have the brains. Was you know, typical kind of British establishment arrogance, but yeah, that was how he phrased it. But the interesting thing there is, it doesn't then follow that Obama did that. And I think actually this claim that Obama personally, you know, directed wiretapping using GCHQ on the Trump transition team, that part is, one, it's a stretch, I think. And two, Spicer was having to issue so many qualifiers there. You know, we're saying that what they said from their source, and that makes us think about this, that something is interesting, isn't it? You know, it's like that. There's nothing there. But your point is right, that there has been traditionally this kind of ability to spy on one another's citizens and then share the results. Like I say, the issue here would be, you know, the level at which it would be being done on the Trump team. Now, the other reaction, this is the Russian thing that will never die.
No, it's always the Russians.
The Democrats and their supporters, and that is, yeah, Obama did order the wiretap. Yeah, because of those Russians. You know, this is the immediate like leap of logic on their side. So, you know, on the Spicer side, you've got him trying to suggest that that Trump's transition team was kind of undermined, and that material was gathered to kind of smear them with through this kind of Obama orchestrated spying operation. Whereas on the Democrat side, they're like, well, yeah, we needed that underhand spying operation because the Russians. So it's just going around in circles, Dave. There's a bubble on the left and there's a bubble on the right. I wish both of them would be popped and we could just kind of all go back to normal, but there's no sign of it yet. The latest kind of Russian smear thing that's been going on was in the pages of The Guardian this week. I don't know if we can mention it here. And this was The Guardian's fabulous laundromat.
Oh, right. Story. Okay. Yeah, explain it.
Now, well, one, it's very clever because laundromat, you know, the M-A-T, mat.
Yeah.
Well, that's where you clean your clothes, isn't it? But the genius part is that mat is also a kind of Russian word. You know, like an ending of Russian words. It's a suffix in Russian.
Ah, so right, okay.
That's the genius of it. So, laundromat. It's,
you know. So, it's, yeah, like, so it's Russian. Yeah, yeah.
It just immediately makes you think of, you know, shady-looking Russians. Now, I'm filing this one.
Polonium 210.
It's a money laundering operation that saw lots of dirty money exit Russia, basically via Latvia, and then move its way on into the so-called, you know, the legitimate banking system. You know,
There's a legitimate one.
Called the legitimate financial system. The one where all the British people with ties that went to public schools work, that part of the financial sector in the City of London. Now, the interesting thing here is that I'm filing it alongside the Panama Papers, that spectacular fail that was all over the news for about 2 weeks, which actually just seemed to be all about trying to say that someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows Vladimir Putin invested in this dodgy company that used this Colombian accountancy firm to hide all its ill-gotten gains all over the world. Oh my goodness, it's the Russians. It's this kind of thing. So just like the Panama Papers, this one was brought to us by, and the Guardian notes this just once as it covers it. It says, the laundromat was discovered in 2013. The first details emerged in public through the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, a highly respected independent collective of investigative reporters. Now, it says independent and highly respected, so you may be surprised by the very next clause, which is part funded by the US Department of State. Okay. And now, if you go on their website and look who funds OCCRP, it gets worse. It really gets worse. Open Society Foundation, Google, Google Jigsaw, the National Endowment for Democracy, and the Knight Foundation. And we also receive money from USAID and the US State Department. So basically, all of these organizations that are, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy, we could do a whole show about them. They've been instrumental in coups all over the world. And people that get involved with the National Endowment for Democracy, they kind of groom controlled opposition that they then use in these kinds of color revolutions around the world. Open Society is George Soros' vehicle. And then USAID is another NGO, which acts as a kind of advanced state within a state, you know, kind of preparing the ground in various countries for covert action. And then the U.S. Department of State. So I'm very surprised. Well, not surprised, but kind of dismayed at how much The Guardian has kind of trumpeted these stories. The best link to Putin they had was that his cousin sat on the board of a bank that was involved in this. And then what they also then did, and this goes back to Trump now, is it then got pointed out that Deutsche Bank, the German bank, now, they are an enormous bank. I mean, you can go and look at the scale of their operation. Enormous. Yeah, Deutsche Bank is involved in Laundromat because they process some of the of this money. And Donald Trump had a loan from Deutsche Bank. It's that, you know, it's like that. It's kind of the smoking gun that they kind of keep searching for. How would Donald Trump, when he borrows money from Deutsche Bank, have any idea that Deutsche Bank, in another part of their operation, is laundering money when these banks themselves say that they didn't know they were laundering money?
Yeah, well, that in the same way, HSBC, when they got caught laundering money for drug cartels from South America, everyone who would have had an account with them would have been responsible then, using the same logic.
Well, that would be the same logic. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that while Donald Trump would have no knowledge of the day-to-day operations of Deutsche Bank, HSBC, which is 71% owned by the UK government, was processing this dirty money.
Mm.
So clearly, the Guardian's real story, if they're really interested in mining this story for its deep content, would be front page, HSBC, UK government involved in money laundering for Russians tied to Putin. No, there's no sign of that headline. You know, that's why I say it goes back to the Panama Papers. The Panama Papers were ludicrous. You know, they're supposed to contain all these thousands and thousands of names, but the journalists, when they searched through it, I don't know what kind of search they're using, but they only threw out people with lots of V's, W's and Z's in their names. You know, no American names came out of there. It was just our Russian friends. You know, they were the ones being fingered by this operation. And despite the way it was kind of presented, it was actually framed a little like a WikiLeaks release. You know, it was this idea that it was this enormous dump of material, and that we were all going to see the kind of the lid being lifted on how all this stuff worked. Yeah, once you actually got into it, only about 100 names ever came out of the database that they had that contained all of this material. WikiLeaks, like them or not, publish everything when they do one of these document releases. WikiLeaks says, well, not just says, but their practice affirms the idea that you, me or you, or anyone listening to this show, we can see all the same stuff that the President of the United States can see, or the Director of the CIA can see, or whoever you want to put in there. But they will show you what the Hillary Clinton, they'll show you what Hillary Clinton read about an issue when she was at the State Department. They'll show you the backwards and forwards. They will give you the power to decide. If you just want to carry on living your 9-to-5 and not go through the material, fine, because there are scholars and journalists and lawyers who will go through it, and they'll find the nuggets and they'll bring them to the public's attention. To me, you know, it's difficult to fault that model unless you're someone actually in government who doesn't want this stuff disclosed, right? But this Panama Papers and this laundromat, no. All the stuff is just held. They tell you it's hundreds of thousands of documents, whatever. They can say whatever they want if they're never going to release it. They can say it's as big as they wish. But then the mainstream media acts as gatekeepers on the story, releases tiny little bits that serve its own kind of agendas. It's nothing comparable, despite the way they present it. It's nothing comparable to what WikiLeaks does. It's just a smear organized by some clever folks at the US State Department. Hopefully it will be gone in a week or two. But I did find it intriguing, like you said, that they'd rather focus on Trump borrowing from a bank which laundered money for blah, 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 rather than HSBC, 71% owned by the UK government, doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that just shows you the, you know, the disconnect. That in itself should really show people that these purveyors of news have basically got certain agendas, because if it was actual news, they would cover more sort of facets of a story. And obviously, they don't. We've explained this. They frame it, basically, you know, change the narrative, reinvent the narrative, or, you know, come up with a completely new one. So
the Guardian's complete 360 since the Snowden leaks. You know, they really become very much the go-to newspaper for the security services, for the intelligence agencies these days. Had a big splash with an interview with the guy at MI6, who was kind of moaning that not enough people of different ethnic backgrounds want to join MI6 and help kind of spy on their fellows. He's kind of lamenting that fact. Things like this. So the Guardian's just done a complete 360, and it's kind of Russophobia is kind of off the scale at the moment. This is just the latest example, but there's been numerous ones. And a guy at the Guardian called Luke Harding, he used to work with WikiLeaks, but he was kind of thrown out. And he wrote a ridiculous expose, supposedly, of WikiLeaks. I think he might be the Julian Assange wears dirty socks guy. But then he wrote an equally ridiculous kind of stuff about Russia, because he got kicked out of Russia too. He's quite a guy, actually. But his spiritual home is at the Guardian. It's become, it's just full of Russophobia these days.
Well, and that's what it is. I mean, you said the other day, actually, an interesting comment that kind of got me thinking, where you said, you know, there is no government that would not want to know less information than your average company. Right. Now, I came across this clip with Tim Allen. I'm not a great fan of his comedy or his films, or, you know, Toy Story, whatever it is you'd probably recognise him from. Or Tall Time, I do believe, was the show you was talking about the other day.
Well, we did talk about it, and you completely threw me by describing him as a comedian, because I'd never associated him with laughter.
No, I think, well, he appeared on Jimmy Kimmel, and obviously when you go on these things, you're promoting something. So at the moment, he's a comedian promoting a tour. So that tells you everything you need to know.
What, and what's on the tour? Tim Allen is the person that you go to see?
Yes.
That seems to be... That's the worst idea I've ever heard for a tour.
Well, do you know, right? So he I'll play the clip and we'll discuss it afterwards.
Have you ever searched for your own house?
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, you have? Yeah, right.
And I'm out there going like this.
I did it too, and I was like, hey, there's my car.
I know. It's a little spooky. That our privacy you give up. You go, and I like Amazon Prime as much as anybody. You shop for a lot. I wish people would shop for the news as much as we shop for a new pair of glasses. I mean, you got to look for stuff. But Amazon, at the bottom of, they suggest things you might like. You mean like the stuff I just bought yesterday? Why do they know way too much about us.
I feel sometimes they send things to my home that I never order.
Just to see if you'd like it.
And I always like it. It's a weird thing. It's like some automatic thing that's going on.
This was a relational database, and I believe it was the University of Wisconsin about 19 years ago. They started this whole thing where they'd give you 10 of your favorite movies. And you go, yeah, I like these five. At what degree do you like them? They compare to another five, then you give it 20 more, and then 30, then you get down to 10. At the end of that, about 30 minutes of this, they'll give you five films that you'd love, and I loved every one of them.
Really?
They sold that to Harrods. That is now the relational database they use on all of us.
On Netflix and what?
Everywhere. Once they know your preferences.
You know what's funny? Sometimes I get on my Netflix queue, and it says what I might like, and I look at it, and I go, oh, I'm an idiot.
Right. So that relational database, I mean, I would assume that's an algorithm, isn't it? That's what, when we hear people going, oh, it's an algorithm. Is that what it would be, an algorithm? But basically it's a mathematical equation that works out your preference when it comes to selecting from certain criteria.
Yeah, it'd be involved in this kind of data mining thing. It's part of this idea that a lot of big internet businesses kind of went into, where the more data you collect, the more you can kind of refine these algorithms and make them kind of better. But for example, a lot of these ones with music do this. I think Spotify,
yes,
is one of them. So if you've got a million people with their playlists, and you see the albums that tend to cluster around the ownership of like maybe there's certain key albums, maybe I don't know, I don't want to discuss music on the show, though that is probably my major passion. But for example, let's take one out of the air, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones. Now if they look at a million people that own Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones, and then someone else comes along and they're only just getting into music, rock music, and then they pick up on one of these ones that people tend to like as well, then, you know, it's going to pop up. Hey, have you tried Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones? It's groovy. So, yeah, it's this kind of thing, isn't it? And then you're just adding value all the time, but it's being refined just through using it. Google is the same thing. I did see an interview with one of the two guys from Google. I do tend to think of them. I can never remember which one is which, right? I'm not actually sure if they themselves know who is the which one, but it was one of them, one of the two. And he was basically pointing out that Google itself learns from all the searches that people make. Particularly, it learns a lot from the incorrect searches. Because when you make a slightly incorrect search and then you refine it and then you find the thing that you were looking for, that incorrect search term, that incorrect string, very, very useful when they're trying to point other people who loosely kind of guess at what they're trying to find. Like a vague guess is better served by these kind of incorrect terms in terms of directing them to the correct goal. You see my point?
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, one reason why Google continues to improve as a search engine over its rivals is just because of the sheer quantity of times that the service has been used, because basically Google learns from every search that is made. That is their model. So Tim Allen is just kind of going into it. We did talk about that. You know, you had your pizza ordering clip,
yes, the other week
on a previous one. Yeah, to go into it, like you said, governments don't want to be shut out from using this kind of data themselves. So every corporation that gathers in customer information, you know, the government wants a piece. It's so useful in terms of spotting patterns. It's so useful in terms of mining to see what kinds of patterns might emerge. So yeah, they just want to. Sometimes, as I said to you, this argument comes up and people will say, well, so what if the government knows just as much about me as Google or Amazon or Facebook? And my rejoinder there is, yeah, but at the moment, Google, Amazon and Facebook don't have police force that they can send around your house to just arrest you and throw you in jail. As long as governments have all these kinds of detention powers to sort of haul you off to a dungeon or extradite you, then you have to be more worried about the use that governments make of their data rather than what Facebook or Amazon are doing. That would be my kind of angle.
Yeah, black bag stuck in the back of a transit and disappeared.
But we did also see when the Snowden revelations came out that the reaction of the NSA and the agencies involved in these programs and the Obama administration, it wasn't to say we're going to stop doing it. But what they then said was, okay, you know, at the moment, we collect all the stuff off the phone networks. We already talked about the AT&T and Mark Klein, Room 641A, on a previous show. They said, all right, you know, we'll stop collecting it, and instead, we'll make the corporations collect it for us and store it instead. Yeah, we'll outsource it. And then, once it's all outsourced, we'll just submit warrants, you know, or we'll just submit requests to these corporations, and then they'll hand over the data anyway. So it wasn't like, oh, we're going to stop it, it's going to tail off, it's going to go away. No, it was just, well, we'll rejig it. And actually, you know, Silicon Valley was not too happy because they were saying, well, before you're just using all those bottomless federal dollars to build up this capacity and build up your big data centers. Well, now you're just saying what we've got to build them and keep all the stuff there for you. I said, well, how's that going to work? Yeah. So, no. It's just this balance, this trade-off between what will happen under the auspices of government and what will be turned over to the corporations to do.
I mean, was it through the Snowden leaks that it was shown that Obama was spying on the likes of Angela Merkel in Germany?
Yeah, it was shown in the Snowden leaks that had happened. But the thing is, Angela Merkel, and this is one of those things, right? Sometimes you do notice that they say, I like the way you say Angela, like a German kind of way. I just call it Angela Merkel. But
okay.
You kind of call it Angela. I don't mind. Angela.
I'm thinking of fishy.
Merkel?
As in Angela. But anyway, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were thinking angelfish. Okay, so the thing was, it's one of those things where German people seem to get more upset on her behalf than she did herself.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those, isn't it? And with good reason, perhaps, because while the German people were saying, hey, you know, our communism in the East, and given our history, you know, we're completely against all this secret police stuff as a society, because we've lived through the consequences with family members spying on one another and people's lives being destroyed by these kinds of practices. This is outrageous. They're spying on our wonderful leader, Angela Merkel. But Angela Merkel not as upset, because Angela Merkel knows that the Snowden leaks also show that the BND, the German equivalent of GCHQ and the NSA, was helping the NSA to intercept Germans' communications and then pass them over.
Yeah, and this is what we mentioned.
Which is actually the bigger story.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. And it's that thing where all the allied countries are basically sharing intelligence, mainly to circumvent the own laws in their own lands that basically prohibit them from spying in their own citizens. So this is, I mean, for me, this has been common knowledge for a few years. I don't understand why, you know, sort of the left brigade that come out and say, how dare does Trump, you know, accuse Obama of doing this? Well, look at what Obama got up to. Look at what GCHQ's got up to. Look at what the NSA's got up to. Look at the Snowden leaks. It goes on and it goes on. So,
yeah, like we quoted William Binney saying, well, of course they do. But William Binney's point was it's happening to everyone. It's not just Trump, it's everyone.
Yes.
I suppose then his point would be, Trump can't really cry foul when it's kind of happening to everyone. That's his kind of point. Yeah, that's the basic thing. And we saw the same thing with the Hillary Clinton emails. James Bamford came out. He's another former NSA guy. And he said, the NSA have every one of those emails. Doesn't matter how many times Hillary Clinton ran a magnet over the over that server. They've got them all. And if they wanted to release them, they could. The point is, they don't need to play the game in that way. All they need you to know is they've got it all. You know, they don't have to come out and wave it around in the media. All that's required is that people within government have the knowledge that we have all of it. That's what's required. We're back to our kind of panopticon again, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, that that scenario where the government basically wants to keep tabs on all of us. And they'll say and do whatever it is they need to do to try and get that into place. But
another notable part of that, though, is that the government, well, this is one thing that, for example, Glenn Greenwald will focus on a lot, and WikiLeaks too, is that as the government comes to know more and more about you, the government itself becomes more and more wrapped in secrecy. So you have no idea what the government is doing. And you might argue the ins and outs of that, you know, in terms of the national security aspect. But another part of it is the political class. For example, in the UK, there's been, as partly a reaction to the expenses scandal, there's been attempts made to make MPs' expenses more transparent. But, you know, now, and in the wake of the Joe Cox, perhaps in the wake of this attack yesterday, mm-hmm. we'll have to wait and see if in the coming week or two we see another move on the part of Parliament to kind of further shroud their spending and their movements from the public gaze. We did mention on a previous show that in Scotland, some members of the Scottish Parliament were upset because some expenses that were published online made it kind of possible by looking at their gas mileage claims to work out where they were driving to and from the Scottish Parliament. And one of them complained, you know, that it showed him going to a village where there's only four houses. So anyone that wants to kind of hunt down this particular MSP and have it out with him was being given a ready means of locating him. So what we're seeing is the political class, who'd want to go and visit an MSP on their downtime? I've got no idea. But we're seeing at Westminster as well that they're very unhappy about having to make this information public. And so, again, I think we've seen some things in recent weeks with they don't necessarily want you to know where they shop in case you go down to Harvey Nichols and try and intercept them.
That was
so
that.
The political class are kind of withdrawing from view, and government itself is kind of withdrawing from view. At the same time, as gentlemen like Max Hastings want to write in the pages of the Daily Mail that our lives should be an absolutely open book. You know, we should have nothing to hide. Maybe we should just all walk around naked. I don't know if that would suit Max Hastings, perhaps.
A bit too cold to do that currently today. But that ties in with that Diane Abbott thing we played a few weeks back, where she was deeply concerned, kind of highlighting the fact that MPs nowadays are basically getting loads of abuse on social media. And this comes under what they would class as hate speech. So, you know, very kind of racist, sexist kind of tones and various messages that according to Diane Abbott, that she's getting personally, but she says that other MPs are also getting. And there's this drive, I think, to put up a wall between the political class and the rest of us, because social media to a certain extent has allowed us to have direct access. You know, if someone doesn't, you don't like somebody, you can send them a message immediately and they'll get it. So yeah, I think it's not going to help matters much in this country when you've got Katie Hopkins going around saying that we are, you know, we're not the United Kingdom at all, we're the complete opposite. And then you've got people like Diane Abbott and the political class trying every trick in the book to not be transparent, to try and put walls up between them and the masses, so to speak.
It's... Well, I would say there, Dave, you know, that is a like powerful point, because in the wake of the murder of Joe Cox, and perhaps with this attack yesterday, what you've seen is that people like Diane Abbott and members of parliament are basically characterizing every member of the public
exactly.
as a potential Thomas Mayor.
That's the word for it, characterizing, exactly.
Yeah, so they show absolutely no faith in the public at large. Instead, we become this kind of just source of endless source of threats. And there's been a few stories. I didn't know you kind of go back to it in this show.
Okay.
But there was a story about how many of these threats against MPs that the intelligence agencies or the Metropolitan Police Service have kind of been involved in tackling on behalf of MPs. But you're right. There's this kind of notion now of this embattled political class who, like Diane Abbott said, her staff beg her not to go and walk around the streets of Hackney. I would beg anyone not to go and walk around the streets of Hackney. But you're right. Like you say, it becomes that the public is judged rather more as a threat than as something to be engaged with. I think that is one point where Jeremy Corbyn does emerge with a lot of credit, because he's the most high profile politician in the country that is decidedly not afraid of walking down the street or sitting on a train or sitting on the underground. You know, Jeremy Corbyn, there's endless tweets of him on social media of people with their selfies with Jeremy Corbyn. If you want to go and speak to him and say hello, it's not a problem. But there's this other kind of MP that very much kind of wants to engage in distancing themselves and erecting more kind of security around themselves. So I'm very interested in the wake of yesterday's attack to see if they might not do that much for the general public. They might not do much for the people who got mowed down on Westminster Bridge, but they might do plenty for the people that were within striking range inside the Palace of Westminster. I'll wait and see on that.
Just as a little caveat to that, you know, yesterday when it came to, you've been around that area as I have, and there's always armed police guards on the front of that gate. And so it's a little bit baffling and how this gentleman managed to get through that and get within striking distance of, where were all the, in fact, and the police officer that got killed was not one of the armed police officers. So where were they? Eventually they turned up. They were there. They killed him. They shot him three times. But they should have been standing out the front. Every time I've walked past there, they're standing out the front with their guns. Where were they?
We might find that happened there is it might be a kind of not a comedy of errors, but it may be that the police officer who was stabbed and who died, it may be that he opened the gate to go outside and see.
Yeah.
What this car that had smashed into the railings, you know, he may have actually gone outside just to see what was going on or even to assist. And unfortunately, you know, he actually let the guy in. So it may prove to be that. Actually, on the free speech and walking around Parliament Square, the first notable time I went there was because I wanted to go and meet Brian Hoare, who has passed away now. But I don't know if you remember Brian.
I don't. So,
well, people listening may. Brian Hoare was the man who waged a he staged a single person protest.
Oh, this is the chap that he was there for
went on for years.
In terms
of having a proper accounting.
I know the guy. I just didn't know his name.
He became a kind of thorn in the side of Boris Johnson and the authorities there.
Yeah, I am familiar with the guy. I just didn't know his name. He was there for a long time.
Was, and his health suffered as a result, and he did kind of pass away in the end, I think, from some of the ill effects. You know, I think he got beaten for his troubles. He got set on fire. It does make you wonder about the kind of wonderful vision of themselves that Londoners are spreading on social media. I did want to mention one last one, which was this news stump meme. That you've probably seen. It's the London Underground sign with the words "We are not afraid" on there.
Yeah.
And lots of people have been circulating this on social media, and there's a kind of spiel that goes with it. But I do find that kind of rather self-indulgent as well, when people that live in in London or in the UK to have the kind of gall to say that we are not afraid. It's like, well, yeah, but your government and its partners, the fear that they're instilling right now, you know, in people in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen, I don't think you're actually as tough or as brave or as resilient as you like to tell yourselves. And I certainly don't think you'd go and take the place of someone out there in the tribal regions of Yemen at the moment, subjected to drone strikes and SEAL team attacks and repeated assaults by the Saudis. Just find it rather self-serving. This kind of, we'll jolly well just, you know, all this kind of blitz spirit and the rest of it, very disappointing to me. I can see the appeal of it, but I also see it as very narcissistic and kind of self-absorbed.
Yeah, I class it in the same tones as those people who, you know, could be on social media, but they change their icon. They feel like they've done their activist bit, and then they carry on with the rest of the day.
Yeah, I put it in the same, the people that actually find the keep calm and carry on sign really, really, you're really cool, maybe even have a mug of it in their homes. That stuff passed me by, because this idea that there's some wonderful resilience that British people have that other people around the world don't quite have. And we've got that kind of, you know, a British problem is if you run out of tea bags or something like this, and oh, I'm terribly sorry.
Yeah, but right.
That kind of side of.
But I mentioned
to me
this.
that just is completely out of keeping with the actual nature of not just British society, but also as I tend to go back to again and again on this show, but the actions of our government.
Yeah, I think I said this week or so ago. I used to work in London in the early 90s when it was the IRA doing terror sort of things in London. And one of the things that used to be propagated on the news after a certain attack or whatever would be, stiff upper lip, Londoners go about their business. It wasn't that. It was the fact that most people had to go to work and earn money. You didn't have a choice. But it's just the way it's framed. Harry's stiff upper lip. Look at how resilient everyone is.
It's like this thing about Paris when they had the Charlie Hebdo attacks. We're told that Paris is the city whose heart is more full of love than anywhere else in the world. And no matter what you do to the people of Paris, they're just going to love one another even more. And in England, it's this kind of, whatever you do to the people of London, they're just going to drink more tea. You know, it's this kind of approach. It's just nonsense to me. But it is at the center of these kind of imperial powers in the metropole. You have this kind of image of yourself, or these images you're invited to have of yourself as being kind of indomitable, impossible. You know, it's impossible to vanquish you. All this kind of stuff. It's just nonsense, isn't it? It's just what people just wish to feel.
Yeah.
That's what I associate it with, kind of narcissism. No.
No.
Drink more
tea. Right. Let's move on.
I'd like all those people, I'd like to just gather them all up, have a teacup, you know, with more tea in it than an Olympic swimming pool, and just kind of dunk them in and out of that tea. Not to drown them, but just kind of like a Tetley's ducking stool, and just keep dunking them in and out of tea until they kind of sober up. That would be my approach to the matter.
Now you've just advertised Tetley's. I'm expecting free tea bags by the time I finish this radio show.
It would be a great attraction. They could put it next to the London Eye. They could call it the London Cup. The London Cupper.
Just a big cup.
Come and be dunked in the London Cupper. Have some sense shaken into yourself. And then you can climb out, you know, with your hair stiff with Tetley's tea or PG Tibbs. Yorkshire tea, whichever one.
Yeah, where others are available.
You know, just do one into the London streets. Go on, just go and do one. I'm having another disturbing thought. But I could tell you an amusing joke about Yorkshire tea, if you wish, at this point.
Oh, right. Intermittent. 10 minutes. Go.
No, it won't take 10 minutes. But when I took my wife to Britain, actually, when we visited you, we moved on to Scarborough in Yorkshire.
Yes.
And we were drinking some of that Yorkshire tea. And my wife said, before we kind of left the region, she said, we need to buy some more of this. And I said, well, why? She said, it's Yorkshire tea. She thought you could only buy it in Yorkshire.
Yeah. Well, if the EU would have had anything to do with it, that would be probably something they would bring in. Like, you know, you can't have certain other foods.
Perhaps that could be part of this travel ban. If, you know, we're going to ban flights from the Middle East, people having iPads and anything bigger than a mobile phone inside the cabin, maybe, you know, Dubai Air will retaliate. Any British Airways flight entering their airspace, no one on board is allowed to have a cup of Yorkshire tea in their hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you have paperwork for it. And a license to carry tea from a different state.
Yeah.
So, the you pointed this one out to me the other day. I came across some reports and stuff, and I have a clip for it. But the UN committee report, Rima Khalif, head of the United Nations West Asia Commission. She resigned, or did she get sacked? I think it was resigned.
She resigned.
Right. And to do with this report, basically stipulating Israel is an apartheid state.
That's correct. I'm intrigued to hear your clip, as I'm not sure what you're going to play. That's why I've gone silent now.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just put it on there then, and we'll have it played.
With every pile of rock and dust moved by this bulldozer, Israel cements its position in the occupied West Bank. This under-construction road divides the Palestinian village of Nebi Ilyas in half. For the people who live here, it's a nightmare. They say it's almost destroyed the local farming community.
I have lost all my land. I have nothing left. And it's not just me. Everyone here has lost something.
Under the 1993 Oslo Accords, the West Bank is divided into three sections, areas A, B and C. A is under full Palestinian control and usually includes the towns and cities. B is jointly controlled by Israel and the Palestinian Authority and is often a village. C is Israeli controlled. However, it's Israel that holds the real power. It can and does shut down roads whenever and wherever it pleases. It often uses gates like these designed and placed strategically just for that purpose. This is Khalil Tafakji, who's a map specialist. He has criticized Israel for policies he says makes a Palestinian state almost impossible.
We have two states in one, a state for Israeli settlers geographically connected, and a state for Palestinian enclaves connected by bridges and tunnels. A Palestinian state in the West Bank is impossible because of the road network and infrastructure.
The United Nations ESCWA report says Palestinians living here in the occupied West Bank and Gaza are, in effect, subject to a separate law.
The wording of the report says that Palestinians are subject in the West Bank to Israeli military law, and that settlers in the same area are subject to Israeli civilian laws. That is in itself a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The report also goes on to say that Palestinians are weakened because of the settlements within the West Bank and because of the siege of Gaza. And finally, the report concludes that Israel is operating an apartheid state.
The Israelis are likely to strongly dispute the report, saying it's yet another example of United Nations prejudice towards the state of Israel. Imran Khan, Al Jazeera, Qalqiyya, in the occupied West Bank.
So, the report basically said that you know, this is what's going on there. And she ends up having to step down.
Yeah, the US and Israel had her removed in short order. The interesting thing, though, was that the report was disappeared off the United Nations website as well.
Did you grab a copy of this before it went?
This one had to be tossed down the memory hole straight away. Yeah, I did grab a copy. Actually, I read the whole report on Tuesday morning before I went to work. So that's my kind of reading time on Tuesday morning. So 74 pages. I read about 50 pages is the meat of it. And in completely sober legal language, it just runs through the definitions of apartheid and how kind of apartheid is being kind of wrongly understood in some instances. For one thing, it says that the comparison between Israel and South Africa is a kind of natural comparison because South Africa was the only kind of recorded example of this apartheid regime. what it says is that there's a kind of wiggle room there, because if you can show something that was true under the apartheid regime in South Africa that isn't true of the regime in Israel, then they can say, well, then it's not apartheid, you know, because you're kind of always matching it against the South African example. But this is legal stuff, so they really understand and investigate all of the distinctions. And what they point out is that apartheid is actually has a definition which is not confined to the South African example, and that there's basically the definition is this kind of racially or the domination of one racial group by another race is the definition. So you don't need it to take the guise, exactly. It doesn't have to be exactly the same shape as the South African approach. Different countries and different regions, you know, they have different histories. And so what you'll actually find is that an apartheid regime that emerges in the Middle East, for example, will have different features to one that emerges in the southern part of Africa. That's one of the things it discusses. I don't think you've read it yourself, have you yet?
I've not, known.
What she then goes through is kind of she outlines the racial basis. And as the guy mentioned in that report, settlers, we'll call them settlers, but we can kind of get into that in its own right. But these settlers that live in the areas like the West Bank that is under, and Gaza, that are under military law for the Palestinians there, for non-Jews, Jewish people that live there, they live under a different law. They live under the kind of the civil laws of Israel. She says that in itself is just an example of, a racial distinction being observed between the two groups.
Well,
and then she also outlines that. Sorry.
I was going to say, I mean, imagine the uproar in this country, in the UK, if, for instance, immigrants had to live under a different law. I mean, people would not tolerate that. And rightly so,
obviously. That's an excellent point, Dave, when you consider how often the there's a large faction of the Labour Party, mostly Blairites, it has to be said, that support the State of Israel. They're very ardent supporters of it. And there's also a large faction, or almost a majority, I believe. It used to be traditional that on becoming a new Conservative MP that you would immediately, you know, automatically join the Conservative Friends of Israel. One thing they're getting upset about is that this little tradition that had been established is starting to break down now. But as you say, if this really is such a wonderful system, why don't we start thinking about copying some parts of it for our own society? No, the answer is we don't have the kind of zealotry and the kind of, we wouldn't want to unleash the racially charged, what would we call it? We wouldn't want to unleash those upon another segment of our population. But one thing that I do find kind of distressing when people discuss Israel is that you cannot separate the Israeli government's actions from the support of its population. You simply cannot. We live in Britain, and for example, we talked about it tonight, the Conservatives selling these arms to Yemen to safeguard jobs at British Aerospace and Siemens, Boeing and all the rest. Yeah. That doesn't mean that if you go out on the street, most people in Britain want to sell those weapons to those regimes. Actually, there's a story this week saying half the people here don't know anything about the war in Yemen, and they don't know it's even going on. But you can't escape the fact that in Israel, these policies have overwhelming popular support. And even people on the supposed left over there are often, you know, they're not really challenging these policies. They're not really challenging them. Another thing the report kind of outlines is that Israel champions like the ability of Palestinians living in Israel to vote and to participate in the political life of the State of Israel. But what the report mentions is that Israeli law prohibits any political party from challenging some of these basic laws of the State of Israel. And one of these laws is the law that basically makes Israel a Jewish state. So what the report says is that this would be a situation where you allowed slaves to vote, but they were not allowed to vote against slavery. It would be this kind of idea. See, so yeah, they do have some rights, you know, to express their political preferences, but there is an enormous area that is kind of screened off. You know, they can't vote. Even if the Palestinians achieved a majority under the Israeli political system, they still would not be able to pass the legislation that would kind of break this system. The state of Israel is incredibly conscious of preserving its character as a Jewish state. So this woman just goes through it all and lays it out in the report, very sober legal language, lots of analysis, lots of examples, and a spot of on-the-ground research. And this, for her sins, you know, leads to this instant massive pushback from Israel and the U.S., and she was gone within 24 hours, and her report has been disappeared. And nothing more can be said about it.
Will you be able to put that report onto your the Inside Track website?
Yes, I can put that report there, and people can have a look at it. That's no problem.
It would be really nice if people are listening. So at least tell us that you're listening. It's very lonely.
I know. I did say to you, Dave, before the show. Usually, I drop in an obscure cultural reference each week for people to appreciate. There are connoisseurs of this kind of thing out there. And my one for this week I was toying with was Doris Stokes, who I believe you didn't really know who she was.
No, not at all.
Well, Doris Stokes, when I was growing up, was a mildly famous kind of clairvoyant or medium who would be indulged on some of the daytime shows. So she would come on and, you know, she would go through her kind of stage routine and just that kind of classic medium stuff. Is there anybody out there?
Yeah.
You know, could you show us a sign?
Hello?
This kind of thing. And then you just wait for a light fitting to fall down in the studio. And then she says, is that you, Malcolm? Well, my point was, I feel very much like Doris Stokes at the moment, because I really do wonder if 9 shows in, we might as well basically just be having private Skypey conversations, because we don't seem to have been given a single sign that anyone is out there actually listening.
Well, that's
my
not...
point was this. Well, there's a few statistics that suggest people are listening, but that doesn't really help, does it? And my point is this. If you are listening to the show, especially people listening live, we've got no way to really know who it is out there. My point is, don't just think, oh, I like that show, I like to listen to it, because you could do just a tiny bit more, which is the, you know, just telling us that you're listening so that we know that people are enjoying it and that we should carry on, rather than us just sort of being utterly in the dark, just chanting into the void about the things that we find interesting.
Well,
just kind of hope.
I know we've... In the past, you know, we've had several people sending messages to the C-Box, and it's a really nice feeling to know that people out there are listening. And especially if you've got particular, you know, you could help produce the show. If you've got clips or you've got news stories that you'd like us to have a look at or to get our opinion on, you know, feel free to go visit Inside Track, which is at bookarmor.com. The C-Box, and drop us something.
I've been monitoring the website while the show is on to see if anyone would comment, and no one has commented, but in the meantime, it's the blog has received like numerous kind of Russian spam bots sending me you know, ads for Viagra pills or something like this. That's the only stuff we've had. I don't really think someone called Igor with his bag of Viagra is really listening to the show.
Two for one, mate. Two for one, little blue pills.
If it was a real person, that's
right.
My plea.
Yeah.
If someone's going to comment now and just sign themselves Igor and completely phase us.
Yeah, Igor, would you like...
Or there's a man called Igor sat there somewhere out there with a big bag of Viagra thinking, what? I can't be selling Viagra and listen to this politics show?
We were going to, we had several more topics. And one of the ones was the the Brexit thing, where...
Well, maybe we could finish with that, because the Katie Hopkins clip I unearthed during my kind of deep research this week is so interesting.
We'll keep that for next week.
Another time.
Yeah.
But this last one about the Brexit, I did... I don't like to refer again to our kind of off the, on the QT kind of conversations, but we do engage with one another in preparation for the show. And you can kind of vouch for the fact that I did bring up this theme in our conversation, which was that the hardcore Remainers or the Remainers would have to start playing a different tune. And I did unearth a story this week that kind of showed them beginning to try to play a different tune and all the ensuing kind of hilarity. So maybe you can take up the story, Dave.
Well, okay, so these two MPs, right, 72 of them, interestingly enough, they basically take a mooch over to Donald Trump. And it's interesting because the word that they use is that these Tory MPs are basically taking a leaf out of Donald Trump's playbook. Now, that phrase playbook, I'd come across by one of these, Sansara Taylor. She is one of these organisers of various anti-Trump rallies and stuff. Refuse Fascism is the group that she's an organiser for. And so she has been on various media outlets propagating the idea that he's a Nazi, that he plays straight from the Nazi playbook. And so it's all very loaded language, you know what I mean, to kind of get into your subconscious and make you think along certain lines. Well, they're having a go at the BBC, right? So they're suggesting to the BBC, you know, it's your fault that you gave out such a dire, dark outcome if we were to leave Brexit. Bearing in mind, it was going to be the end of the world. It was going to be the end of life in the UK as we knew it. Stock markets were going to crash. Sadly, none of that actually happened. Right? Now, some people would suggest that's because we're not physically left yet. Well, a lot of the scare stories, if you remember, just before the 23rd of June last year, was just the idea of muttering that we were going to leave was going to cause this. Right? And none of it did. So these MPs are now blaming the BBC for losing the referendum because they were just too dark. They were just too scaremongery. All bad BBC.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about this. There was also this story that was coming out that even the Russians influenced the Brexit referendum. So there's always someone to blame.
The Russians.
Campaign, isn't it, that you can blame as many people as you want, but the person you mustn't blame is Hillary Clinton. So with the Remain campaign, the person you mustn't blame is what, a few Blairite Labour MPs, I think, because they blame Jeremy Corbyn as well. And they did blame him. There's a lot of the supposedly Jeremy Corbyn didn't do enough to mobilize Labour's grassroots to get them all out to vote to stay in the EU. You actually went down a different route there. My Brexit story was a bit different to yours. I kind of set it up wrongly. Oh, but yeah, okay. This idea of casting around for villains of the piece to pin the horror of Brexit upon. It's still kind of ongoing. It's getting more and more desperate, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's happened. It doesn't really matter what the post-mortem is on it now. In the meantime, we've kind of seen that the Article 50 is about to be triggered at the end of March. And there was an alternative take, I think it's this guy Jeremy Seabrook, or Seagrave, and his point was the Remain campaign are now in a bubble, a little like we talked about the left and the right in the US. And he said it's incredibly damaging because instead of getting on with thinking about what this deal needs to be, they're still locked in this idea that they can stop it somehow. And instead, they're just either focused on stopping it dead, and they did all that with their legal challenges. And now the other one is, we need another referendum.
Yeah, and that's
a new thing. But the point is, the second referendum could only be on which deal to accept, or it could even be like the deal or no deal kind of thing. But it would not be possible to have on the referendum ballot paper stay in the EU. That will not be an option. That will not be an option. It will only be, you know, do you want to leave in this way or do you want to leave in that way?
Right, but okay.
For these Remain people, they still don't seem to have got to that point yet of being able to just accept it. They just keep trying to unwind what's already transpired. I wasn't a huge fan of the EU, but actually, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the UK government either. And swapping the kind of Eurocrat side of things just for endless kind of Tory governments, you know, it's neither here nor there to me. I moved to Asia because I don't want to live under any of it. But, you know, neither is attractive, actually. There's not really any good options that can come out of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true, actually, what you say about this bubble that they say, because the same thing's happening in America with Trump. It seems to be becoming it is getting more and more extreme. The name calling, the I have a song for later for finishing. Friends in Safe Spaces. Kind of thought it was fitting. That whole point of the left sort of paradigm getting all wrapped up in their self-importance and basically saying, well, we need to do democracy again. You know, you didn't vote the right way. You need to vote the right way. That's because you're a racist. That's because you're a knuckle dragger. It's because you're an idiot. This is what happens when we let idiots vote and they vote the wrong way.
I heard all this stuff too.
Yeah. It's all of that kind of rhetoric. And now I know people who have come out with that. I see quite a lot of it on Facebook. Every now and again, one pops up and it's just really, really... Don't you understand what it is you're doing with one hand? You're sitting there going, yeah, I'm fighting for freedom. I'm fighting for, like, democracy. And on the other hand, you're sitting there torching it. Because someone has a different opinion.
This is it. It actually revealed a very anti-democratic strain on the left, which I kind of wasn't as familiar with as I should have been. But I was kind of very disappointed about that. And the idea that it's kind of virtue kind of signalling, you know, the reason we voted Remain is because we're smarter than you. Whereas in actual fact, it depends on kind of the Katie Hopkins clip next week does tie into this. So I won't say much more than that. But there's more to it than just saying we're smarter, so we voted to stay. Maybe the EU was working better for the people with more formal education than it was for the people without. That is one point. The Brexit story I wanted to bring up, Dave, was this going soft on their stopping Brexit kind of rhetoric, and that was this march that they're doing in London. Are you familiar with this?
Not this particular march. I've covered a few of the others. What one's this?
Well, it's tomorrow.
Right.
I say tomorrow. It's already Friday here, so it's Saturday.
Saturday, right.
It's Saturday, and originally we were led to believe that this Brexit march would outdo the protests against getting involved in the Iraq war, which you may remember had about 2 million
people. Yeah, a lot of people, yeah.
So now it looks like they'll have trouble getting 20,000 people. But the interesting thing to me was that they've had to start watering down their Stop Brexit slogan. So I don't know if you can... I'll run their new slogan by you.
Can you?
They've gone from Stop Brexit to the... Make your voice heard.
Oh, excellent.
That's their new one.
That's going to solve everything.
Yeah.
You know, just shout a bit louder.
Make your voice heard. What they said was, they've also, they're not sure now if they're going to have the giant model of Theresa May with a pistol in her mouth. They're not sure.
if they're going on the back of a float.
Or not.
That would be a carnival.
Actually, after this terror attack, probably on the grounds of taste and decency, they'll probably have to drop that now, won't they?
Yeah.
But what's going on is the guy who was organising it, this guy called Peter French, has kind of had to step down in mysterious circumstances, and so now people on Facebook are kind of, it's a bit like you know, they're angry. One of them said, "This is going mushy," and another one said, "It's watered down pap," which I. Very damning criticism. So another one said, people are dropping like flies, to be honest. It's a lot of work. And if you do go along on Saturday, I wouldn't advise anyone to go, but you can listen to Tim Farron, the absurd leader of the Liberal Democrats. And you can also listen to Harvard graduate, but can't quite use the English language properly, MP David Lammy. So get yourself along there if you want to. If you do go, please take a few photos and send them to us. And you might make a few new friends by the sound of it. They've got a group called 16 Million Rising. So I'm just waiting to see how many of them rise on Saturday. I'm really keenly awaiting this rather pointless protest by now, just to see how many people turn out. And I'm also, I hope it doesn't rain, because I do not want to hear the wind and the rain being paraded as an excuse for why 1.8 million people stayed at home that day. So yeah, this is just something to watch, but they're already having to water down their message. That's what's going on now with the Stop Brexit movement. It's now make your voice heard. There we go.
Right, just to we ran out of time, so we're going to end the show. But just because I had a clip lined up for it, and I need to play it, and it's a classic. I told you the other day, Jay, about the swearing ban that's coming in Rochdale. Yeah, £100 on the spot fines if you're caught using an expletive in the middle of Rochdale.
Actually, is the studio for the radio show in the middle of Rochdale?
Yes. Yes, that's why we keep it soundproofed and locked. So
you can swear live on, air. Maybe a policeman will hear and come and arrest you.
Either that or the council will withdraw their funding.
Well, I'm in Taiwan. Am I covered?
Yeah. I imagine you're covered. Well, you
would
should
I have
be.
To pay £100?
Well, the Rochdalian police will have to come and get you, mate.
We'll let the two runners do it for us.
Okay. This will be funny.
Evening, Mr. Parson.
Evening, Dolly. Well, how's the beer? Flat as usual.
Now watch it, Mr. Parson. You'll have to mind your language in here from now on. Look here.
What's a swear box? That's a good idea. Is it for charity?
The church fund. 5p a time.
Oh, you'll make a 40 out of me.
Well, you're right now. You owe me 20p already.
20p?
25 now.
Oh, all right. You got change for a quid?
You won't need much change if you carry on like this.
Oh, that's true. Two right, I would.
Evening, all. Evening, Joe.
Hello, Gilbert.
Oh, a bit nippy over there. You're going for a fall of snow. That's all you need.
Well, I need 20p from you, Mr. Robbins.
Yeah, I've got a swear box in here now. Don't worry. Have these on me. That's a good idea. Yeah. For the church. 5p a time, see?
Quite right, too. My timeless lot did something from the church.
Yeah, dozy lot.
What will cost you 10p?
10? Told me that.
You never asked me. It's 5p for and 10p for.
Never mind all this. I'm standing here like a. What are we going to have for drinks? I'm going to have a pint of best beer, Dolly, I think. What are you going to have, Joe?
I think I'll have £5 worth of silver, please, Dolly. And I'm going to take this swear box. I'm going to sit over here. We'll have a decent, civilised conversation. Well, how's your love life, then, Gilbert?
Non-existent, mate. How's yours?
Oh, not too. Grand. I had an argument with a wife last Friday night about going to the dogs. I said I was going anyway. Well, she hit me around the table with a saucepan.
What are you doing here?
What did I do? I hit her back. Dozy old.
Horses. That one will cost you £1.
£1? It's getting a bit. It's expensive in here.
Richie's making a f*** out of you. Trying to f*** about the
Good evening, Dolly. Oh,
hello, Vicar.
Good evening, gentlemen.
A double lemonade and water, please. I say, the swear box looks mighty full.
Yeah, and Dolly tells us all going to the church. Yeah, that's a nice surprise for you, eh, Vicar?
Surprise? I'm the who thought of it.
Priceless.
Right, okay, so that'll be the end of our show for today. Thank you for joining us all, those who are listening. Thank you, Jay, as always.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, everyone.
And we'll be seeing you next week. And please go visit our website. Drop us a line. Let us know you're out there. Take care, everyone. See you later.
Blame it all.